You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hello, I'm Miles O'Brien in for Leonard Lopate today. Special day here on The Leonard Lopate Show. You know, there's nothing worse for an author than being ignored. And by that standard, Tony Blair's weighty memoir is a big hit. We can't honestly say the reaction is all in the rave category. He's had to cancel some book signings, security concerns. He's been on the receiving end of a few eggs, and he's been heckled a few times. He's been accused of lifting some dialogue from a movie. We'll ask him about that. But hey, people are talking. He broke the Nielsen record for first week book sales. He has the number one memoir on Amazon, number 17 overall. The memoir is entitled A Journey, My Political Life, written by the former Prime Minister Tony Blair. It is published by Knopf, and we are Knopf, and we are happy. Got to get the K in there. We are most happy to have him here in the studio there. Mr. Blair, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Miles.
You begin in America in your book, which we thought was interesting. Tell us about why did you start there? And tell us a little bit about this special relationship between the two countries, how you view it.
Well, it ended up being such a big part of my premiership. I mean, to be absolutely honest about it, when I came in 1997 as a fresh prime minister, you know, we'd been 18 years in opposition. We come into power. My head was full of domestic policy, and the country was full of huge expectations. And then suddenly I found myself, after 9/11 particularly, just really fixed in foreign policy concerns and the security threat. And that was very much to do with the relationship with America. And that relationship is, you know, some of the people in my own country didn't like the fact that I was very much shoulder to shoulder with America. But I think it's an important relationship for my country, for yours, and actually for the world.
That relationship which you fostered with two presidents, it ultimately was your undoing, I suppose, if you look at it, with the relationship with George Bush and the war. Do you regret being as close to America as you were?
No. I mean, I knew at the time it was going to be very difficult and, in a sense, politically perilous. But on the other hand, I thought what we were doing was right. So I thought it was important to continue. And I also, partly because I had a strong relationship with Bill Clinton, obviously, as well. And we had first taken military action, actually in 1998 in respect of Iraq, but then obviously in respect of Kosovo, where we'd gone to the aid of Kosovo Muslims under oppression from a Serbian government. And, you know, frankly, without his intervention, without America's intervention, we could never have saved those people from ethnic cleansing. So I had a, you know, pretty good idea of why this strategic alliance mattered.
The Kosovo event was a very important event for you and obviously solidified your relationship with Bill Clinton and the United States. You describe it, I believe, the term you use is a kind of moral justification for a war, a humanitarian war, even though that sounds a little bit like a contradiction in terms. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is one of the most difficult things, and we face this problem still today, is that when you intervene, obviously there are very serious consequences of intervention and a lot of challenges and difficulties. But actually, we had an example in the early 90s where we didn't intervene in Bosnia and hundreds of thousands of people died. We didn't intervene in Rwanda. Ethnic cleansing on a scale, almost a million people died in that. So non-intervention also can have its consequences. So I suppose really what I began to formulate was an idea that in a world that's increasingly interdependent, where the security threats in one part of the world affect those in another part, then in a sense, it's not just a question of moral justification. An enlightened view of your self-interest means you can't ignore what's happening.
Well, so there's a mix there, though, because there's a moral justification, and that usually puts things in more or less black and white terms. But in the real world of politics, there are many shades of gray. So how do you decide where to draw the lines in the sand when you use that as your way of informing interventions?
Sure, it's a really good point, and it's very, very difficult. I mean, you know, we face actually the same type of a very binary decision in respect of Iran today. So how do you draw up the rules for that? And I think in the end, you've got to make a judgment, which is not simply about the moral dimension, but is also about security and about the risk. And I think the single toughest thing in the world today, you know, and I see this being out in the Middle East, out in Israel and Palestine a lot of the time, is, you know, can we actually afford to try and manage this extremism, or are we obliged, in fact, to confront it? And it's a really, really difficult choice. And I still think today that choice is there.
The cliche is you got to pick your battles, right? And it's always easy in retrospect to decide where to go. But as you look back, say Rwanda, what do you wish you might have done that you didn't?
Well, I wasn't in power at the time, but I think and hope that if Rwanda happened again, we would find the strength to intervene. I had a similar, not as well, I suppose actually for Sierra Leone, it was as complicated a situation where, you know, if you've ever seen the film Blood Diamond,
sure,
that was what was happening in Sierra Leone. I actually sent British troops there to sort out this gangster group, and now this is a democratic country. But it's the scars of that conflict are still there, and it'll take a long time, incidentally, for the country to get to its potential. But, you know, I think if I hadn't intervened, you know, you might still have had the bad people in charge of Liberia that were in charge of Liberia, the bad people in charge of Sierra Leone. And, you know, now you can say, well, what does that matter to people in Britain? I don't know, but I think that the way the world is today, these conflicts very rarely stay localized.
Well, it's and this is where politics meets global leadership, and sometimes it's difficult to do both. It's difficult to play to a local audience, your constituents, after all, and you did ride to power with New Labour with a huge landslide victory. And then when you start leading on the world stage like that, you lose support. How do you make those real politic versus leadership decisions?
It's really, really difficult, particularly. And, you know, that's why I hugely empathize and sympathize with President Obama today, because people say, you know, the economy's the issue. So the president should be sorting that out. And then when he actually has a launch, which I attended at the White House, of the Israel-Palestine peace issue, you know, there's lots of people saying to him, why are you concentrating on this? You've got the economy. Now, the truth is, he's got to concentrate on everything. And what I found when I was prime minister was, yes, you know, my country wanted healthcare was our big issue, wanted us to sort out the National Health Service, issues to do with crime and immigration and education. All of that was true. But as I used to say to people, the one thing a president and prime minister doesn't get to do is they don't get to choose the in-tray, really. You know, and it would be nice and very neat if issues came sequentially. You know, for the next 6 months, the economy is going to be the issue. After that, we got 6 months of foreign policy. Doesn't happen like that.
You just can't put it on your calendar and expect that to happen, can you?
No, yeah. And the events come thick and fast.
So how did Kosovo ultimately change the way, perhaps, you viewed Iraq and later Afghanistan?
I think I was, you know, the reasons for Iraq and Afghanistan were very much connected with 9/11 and obviously not to do with the same issues in relation to Kosovo. But at the same time, I think what Kosovo did bring home to me was that the failure to act also has severe consequences. Because the truth is, Kosovo really came out of the failure to act in the early 1990s, when it was very obvious, when the former Yugoslavia split up, there was going to be a great deal of trouble.
So the failure to act is what was on your mind in the run-up to the war?
Yes, because I think that, you know, in the end, although the consequences of action can be severe and immensely challenging, the consequences of inaction can also be like that.
Now, in the run-up to the intervention in Iraq, there was a lot of, frankly, probably deliberately confusing rhetoric in this country, linking, for example, Saddam Hussein to 9/11. When you heard that kind of talk, I mean, presumably you weren't making that link, were you?
No, I wasn't. I was always very, very clear about this, that the reason 9/11 impacted on the Iraq situation was not because Saddam had been responsible for 9/11. It was because the terrorism that killed 3,000 people in one day in New York, if it could have killed 30,000 or 300,000, it would have. Now, that was the thing that mattered to me. So what I then thought was that after that, the calculus of risk changed. Anybody who had anything to do with WMD had to be confronted and made to choose. You either get into line with the UN resolutions, with international, the doctrines of the international community, or we are going to take you on because of the fear of leakage from that program. So because Saddam had used chemical weapons against his own people, he'd used it in the Iran-Iraq war, because he was in breach of UN resolutions, he was the place to start. But we didn't simply look at Saddam. I mean, we looked at Libya, we looked at North Korea, we looked at Iran at the time, and we looked at the activities of the Pakistani nuclear scientist, AQ Khan, who had been proliferating this stuff.
But this notion of a preemptive war was unprecedented in U.S. history. Were you cognizant of being a part of that? Were you uneasy with this preemptive nature of it all?
I'm slightly uneasy at the term, actually, because I think, in a way, what this was really about was to say to those, I mean, you know, Saddam had been in breach of those UN resolutions over a long period of time. And in a way, the world had said, look, okay, he is, but we'll just manage that situation. And we tried sanctions, and the sanctions regime was crumbling. He was obviously, you know, in a position where he could get round the sanctions. But people were very much before 9/11. I mean, I remember the debates at the time on Saddam. And as I say, the first military action I took in respect of Iraq was with Bill Clinton. And it was actually he who signed the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998, calling for regime change. So what really happened after 9/11 was that that attitude of, well, look, let's manage this situation. I mean, it's not, it's important, but it's not dramatically important, changed. That's really what came home to me. So when we talk about it being preemptive, it was really that notion that you could allow people to flout the international community on that issue had terminated.
But to get Americans to go along, the Bush administration, and I'm thinking of Vice President Dick Cheney, who said it frequently, made that link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. Did you, I don't recall you publicly saying anything, but did you privately say, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing that?
No, actually, publicly at the time, I always used, because I was obviously asked this in Parliament the whole time, I used to say, look, the issue is not whether Saddam personally was responsible for 9/11. The issue is, how do we now make sure that these terrorists never acquire nuclear, chemical, or biological capability? Because what the evidence of 9/11 shows you is if they do, they may well use it.
Now, of course, we know the WMDs were not there now. Were you convinced, absolutely convinced at the time that they were?
Sure, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's interesting now is to read the Iraq Survey Group that was compiled after the war and after we sent in the new team of people to go and interview Saddam's henchmen and lieutenants, and actually Saddam himself. And the picture that emerges there, I think, really explains, in a sense, the intelligence failure as well, which is that Saddam thought that he had to get rid of sanctions, but he kept the know-how, he kept the people that were working on that program. Not all the intelligence, incidentally, has been shown to be at fault. And he kept the intent of restarting that program in nuclear and in chemical weapons.
Do you really believe that would have happened?
I think there's a fair chance it would have, because, you know, if you read their reports and the interviews with the key people, he saw his use of chemical weapons against Iran in the 1980s and then against his own population in the early 90s and late 80s as an essential part of the maintenance of his regime. Now, I can't say that it would have, but that's where you come back to this judgment on risk. And so when people say to me now, well, since that intelligence was wrong, do you think you should just have left Saddam there? My view is no. In the end, I think you would have always have had to have come back and dealt with him.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates here has said that the premise for the war was wrong. And paraphrasing him, as a result, it will always be clouded, no matter what the ultimate outcome is. And we're still seeing it play out. Would you go along with that?
Well, I mean, you've got to go along, and with the fact that the intelligence turned out to be at fault, and you know, I've taken responsibility for that. What I think is also true, however, and I see this particularly out in the region now, is that the fact that Iraq has the chance to decide its own future with its own democratically elected leaders, with all the challenges, you know, it's an interesting thing. You will meet many people out in that region who say, "Well, we disagree with that decision." But there aren't many people who are sorry that Saddam isn't there.
But hasn't it fed the war on terror?
I don't believe that, actually. I mean, I understand why people say that, but I think we've got to be really careful of this. Because, you know, when people say, as a result of your decision to get rid of Saddam, we provoked this extremism, I think we just got to go back and look at the facts for a minute. We got rid of Saddam in 2 months. By mid-2003, US and British and other forces were there in Iraq with the full consent of the international community, with the United Nations backing. The UN were in Iraq with the oversight of the democratic process. When those terrorists then killed, first of all, the UN people, but then started to kill their own people, because this is Muslim-on-Muslim violence, they didn't do it because we were provoking them. You know, and we've got to be really careful of this argument. Because in my view, one of the reasons why we're finding it hard to defeat this extremism is that a bit of our own opinion kind of comes at this from the point of view of, well, we've sort of caused this. We haven't caused it. I mean, nothing happened before 9/11 that could possibly have justified or given rise to such an attack. And I think we're deluding ourselves, actually, if we believe that this extremism is a product of our policy. It's not. It's a product of something very deep within Islam, based on a perversion of Islam, but nonetheless real and there.
But to the extent that interventions such as that fan those flames, there is some culpability, isn't there?
Well, but you see, Miles, I think the interesting thing is when we say the intervention fans the flames, what is the fanning, really? That we get rid of a brutal dictator who killed hundreds of thousands of his own people and replace it with a democratic process and unlimited money in order to help rebuild the country. And then these people come in from the outside, al-Qaeda. I mean, al-Qaeda in Iraq was led by people from the outside, Iranian-backed militia. They try to destabilize the country. Who's oppressing and who's helping? I think our forces were in there helping the people. We were trying to stop people being killed. And the people who drive cars and bombs into Baghdad now and try and kill as many people as they can, I think they're the people that are doing the oppressing. So, you know, one of the things that interests me about this situation is people say to me, you know, well, the American presence in Iraq, it's provoked this extremism. So if that were true, what we would expect is as American forces withdraw, the extremists should stop. But what do we actually find? As American troops withdraw, they try and redouble their efforts to destabilize. And that shows me what I see actually right around the region is that this isn't about our provocation. It's actually about their extremism.
But al-Qaeda was not in Iraq before the invasion.
Well, actually, al-Qaeda did come into Iraq before the invasion, but I agree it was not a major factor there. But what do we say when we say, if we remove a dictator and give you a democratic process, this provokes these people to come and do these things? I think we've got to be really careful of that argument. Because after all, that's their argument now in Afghanistan, where everyone was in favor of Afghanistan. Okay? So nowadays, what they say is it's the American presence in Afghanistan that means we have to go and kill these innocent people in Kabul or down in Helmand or wherever. Well, it's not. I mean, the fact is they are killing people without any provocation from us. They're doing it in order to thwart the will of ordinary Afghans and indeed people everywhere. Look at what they're doing in Pakistan. Now, why are they killing, you know, why are they driving bombs into street markets in Pakistan, killing people the other day at a religious ceremony? This is Muslim-on-Muslim violence. It's got nothing to do with what America's doing. It's directed actually at their own countries in order to try and destabilize them and in order to prevent them making the progress they want to see.
Are you proud of the war in Iraq?
You don't talk about war in the sense of pride as a decision maker like that. Do I think that it was the right thing? I believe it was, but I don't disrespect anybody who takes the opposite point of view. And I think the judgment on it will be a judgment made over a prolonged period of time.
My guest is former Prime Minister Tony Blair. His memoir is called A Journey, My Political Life. It's published by Knopf. We'll continue after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, whose weighty tome. It is weighty.
Well, I was also readable, actually, Miles, which is more important than what it weighs. Yeah,
it's called A Journey, My Political Life, in case you haven't heard about it yet, but it is out there all over the place. People are talking about this book. We were talking about Iraq. Let's move into Afghanistan. First of all, As you referenced earlier, nobody complained about that intervention because it was directly connected to 9/11. But it lingers, and it's becoming in many ways Obama's war. That's the way it's been characterized. What is to be done about the Taliban? That at one point in your book, you referenced that we sort of took care of the Taliban. We all thought that. Not so. They're still there.
Absolutely.
What is to be done? And I know your country has a long history, frankly, a bloody history in Afghanistan. Empires fall there, don't they?
It's tough in Afghanistan. But it's tough for different reasons than in the past when frankly, the British were there as colonial masters. This is about trying to give the Afghans the chance to live their life properly. And, you know, it's one of these things when you actually read about what it was like with the Taliban, girls not allowed to be educated, people subject to a brutal type of religious theocracy. I mean, the fact is Afghanistan as a country years ago was a country that had huge prospects and still has huge prospects. And I think what we've got to do is obviously not just on the military side, but on the civilian side, we've got to try and empower Afghans, their own security forces, their own government to take control of the country. The reason it's so hard, though, is exactly the same reason as it's hard everywhere, all over the world where this is a problem. And that is because those people who use terrorism create a situation of insecurity where it's really hard for the political and civilian leaders to make progress.
And, of course, that insecurity is everything for people. They can't trust who we would like them to trust, in essence, if they don't feel safe. They reach out to the Taliban because they provide that security.
Or they provide the intimidation. And that's absolutely. No, you're right. I mean, the problem is you've got to create a situation in which people have confidence that the better life that they want is going to be properly there for them.
So it seems to me that the way to approach it would be either to pull out entirely or go in there in much larger numbers and provide and fill that vacuum. Would you go along with that?
I don't think it's in much larger numbers. And obviously, we want to get our troops home. You want to get your troops home. But I do think we have to redouble our efforts to build the capacity and the institutions capable of governing, and in particular, the security forces. Because, you know, the real thing that gave us the chance and gave Iraqis the chance in Iraq was when we were building the indigenous Iraqi capability of handling their own security. And that's the critical thing. And, you know, I work with the Palestinians at the moment, building up their rule of law and their security institutions now. And the great difference, the reason why in the West Bank now, in Palestine, you've got the economy growing very strongly, is because the Palestinians are providing security. As a result of that, the Israelis are lifting the checkpoints, and therefore people are able to gain, you know, access to prosperity and move forward. Now, it's the same everywhere. This is the problem. If you can't provide the security, you can't provide the opportunity.
And you have a government there, the Karzai government, that is corruption is the word that comes to mind. That's a difficult thing to fix.
It is difficult to fix. But I think, you know, there are all those issues to do with the nature of the government. But certainly when I talk to British forces down in the south, which is part of the area that's toughest down there, security is the issue.
You were talking about the Middle East. We might as well go there because you are leading the quartet, I guess, is the way to describe it. And that has nothing to do with musical instruments. But we'd like it to play a song of peace in the Middle East, if that could be possible. Secretary of State Clinton has used the term the last chance for peace, that now may be the last chance. Do you go along with that?
Well, it's a very stark way of putting it. But on the other hand,
indeed.
I think when you look at it, she may well be right. You know, we've tried for many, many years to get a process going that yields a result. And actually, believe it or not, you know, over the years with President Clinton, you know, in the year 2000, and then even at the tail end of the Bush presidency with Condi Rice, we actually did have a chance for peace. Now, the truth is, at this present time, if we don't make this work now, and President Obama has pushed this right from the outset of his presidency, it's hard to see where we're going to go.
It's amazing how close we were under the Clinton years, right?
Yeah,
I mean, really,
no, we
was,
were. But was very close. And incidentally, any solution to this will come back to basically the same type of issues.
It comes back to the same issues, but it also comes back to, are the leaders willing to take a chance? And is the current leadership in that region ready to do that, you think?
I think they are. But I think the reason why I think we've got a chance now is that I think we have the right relationship between what I call the bottom-up building of a Palestinian state and the top-down political negotiation to get one. And here's the thing that I think is so important. And I know it's a funny thing now. I spend so much time. I was just in Jerusalem a couple of days ago. I spend so much time out there. I actually have a far clearer understanding, I think, today than I did when I was British Prime Minister, curiously. The real problem is what I call an on-the-ground reality problem. And the problem for the Israelis is very simple. It's security. That is their problem. if they believe that the Palestinian state next to them is going to be properly governed and properly run by people who are friendly and not hostile to the state of Israel, then they can accept a Palestinian state. If they think they're going to get Hamas running the West Bank, they're going to be very worried about it, rightly. So security is the Israeli problem. The Palestinian problem is, even if they make these changes necessary on capacity, on rule of law, on security, will the Israelis get out and let them have the run of their territory? And can they reunite Gaza with the West Bank? So each side has its, what I call, reality on the ground problem. And what I work on is trying to deal with that issue, that reality issue.
So it's not as simple, this whole, you know, the cliche is land for peace. It's really more subtle than that.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, look, if borders were the only issue, could you resolve it? Of course you could. You know, Jerusalem, refugees, they're all difficult issues. But let's be clear about this. We've gone over this ground many, many times over the past years. Most sensible people could try and work out a way through those issues. The tough thing is security, the concern of the Israelis, occupation, the concern of the Palestinians. If you can't work your way out of those two issues, then I think it's unlikely that the political negotiation succeeds.
Now, what about the settlements, though? The moratorium on the settlements set to expire. If bulldozers start moving again and Israelis start building settlements, that changes everything, doesn't it?
Well, what's important there is to understand what's the basic principle we're trying to protect here. And the principle is that we don't want anything being done that prejudges the final outcome and that makes it impossible to get that independent state. So if Israel were building settlements, you know, right in the heart of Palestinian territory, this is going to be a huge inhibition on reaching a deal. Now, I hope there's a way of protecting the negotiation whilst dealing with the political problems that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas have that allow us to move forward. Because in the end, the answer to settlements is to resolve borders.
You were talking about, before we came on the show, about how the situation in Iran actually plays to your advantage as you try to negotiate this through the quartet. Explain how that is working. What's the dynamic there?
The big change in the region, and sometimes, you know, the external factors can play a big part in getting a peace deal, as I found in Northern Ireland, indeed. The big change in the region is that, truthfully, not just Israel, but the other countries in the region are worried about Iran. They're worried not just about them trying to acquire nuclear weapons capability, they're worried about their policy of destabilizing the region and exporting terrorism and financing and arming it. So that focus is a focus that is a, you know, it's not often expressed like this, but is in a curious way a sense of unity between Israel and its Arab neighbors.
That's a half-full way of looking at Iran, I suppose. But looking at Iran without perhaps the benefits that might be created by that change in the dynamic, what's to be done about that? Is there really a military option? I mean, what if the Israelis struck at the nuclear capability of Iran?
Well, the difficulty that you've got here and the tough thing that's involved in it is, you know, sometimes people say to me about the Israelis, well, they shouldn't worry too much about what Ahmadinejad says. But if the president of Iran says that he wants to wipe Israel off the face of the map and at the same time is trying to acquire nuclear weapons capability, if I were an Israeli, I'd be pretty concerned about it. So I think that, you know, I don't want to see the military option used. On the contrary, I want diplomacy and sanctions and so on to work. But I do think we have to be very clear with Iran and give them a very simple, unambiguous, absolutely crystal clear message, which is that you won't be allowed to acquire this capability. Now, you know, people will then say, well, then let's discuss all the military options. You shouldn't do that right now, but you can't take that option off the table, I'm afraid.
It has to stay there.
It has to stay there because the consequences of allowing Iran to get that nuclear weapon. And, you know, people say to me often, particularly over in Europe, look, so what? Iran has a nuclear weapon. Maybe we can handle it. You know, why would the regime be stupid enough to use it, et cetera, et cetera. And I understand all those points. But, you know, when I see what Iran is doing in the region and actually arming and financing and supporting terrorism within the region, is it sensible when a regime's doing that to give them the ultimate weapon of have a nuclear arm. I can't think it is. So, again, you know, this is why these decisions are so difficult, frankly, in today's politics. It's a calculus of risk, again. You know, what is the bigger risk? Is the bigger risk acting, or is the bigger risk inaction?
We've been talking about politics. Let's talk about religion. These are two things my mother told me never to talk about. But here we are. So let's talk religion. It turns out you in almost a passing reference in your book, you say, I'm actually more interested in religion than politics. Interestingly, since you've left office, you've converted to Catholicism, your wife's religion. I assume that was something you couldn't do while you stayed in office. That was not...
Yeah,
that was a non-starter, right?
Miles, I had enough on my plate by then without adding, you know, Catholicism. And I mean, it's a very personal thing. My wife's a Catholic. My kids were brought up as Catholics. I've been attending Mass for 20, 25 years. So it was no disrespect to the Church of England. I just felt at home in the Catholic Church. But my interest in religion is, you know, I have a foundation now that's about religious interfaith. And we do programs, for example, of education where we link up schools across the world of different faiths so that children can talk to each other about their faith and about their difference and how they get on together. And I think, you know, my focus on this is because I think that although the 20th century was dominated by fundamentalist political ideology, I think the 21st century is more likely to be dominated by religious or cultural ideology. And therefore, the concept of faiths working together in an era of globalization, I think, is a crucial point.
Which brings us to Islamophobia, or whatever the term you want to use. We've obviously been focused on that an awful lot here in New York City with the plans for the Islamic Center. I was reading today in the paper about what's happening in France, outlawing of burqas and other body covering for women. What can a foundation do? What can we all do to try to stem that? It seems 9 years after 9/11 that it's much worse than ever.
Yes, and I think that's why, you know, we've got to be clear about this. This is something very deep that's going on, and it's going to take a long time to deal with. I think what we can do is to try and say, as I tried to say after 9/11, that was an attack not on America, but on everyone who shares certain civilized values. And one of those values is that we are equal before God and before the law, whatever our race or faith or creed. And I think, you know, the two competing strains in today's world are those that believe that actually we can achieve peaceful coexistence between people of different faiths, and those who believe we're involved in some clash of religious or cultural belief that is fundamental and that has to be resolved by one or other winning. Now, that latter view is powerful in certain parts of the world, but it leads us directly into conflict.
Now, a year ago at Georgetown, you talked about this, and you talked about confronting Islamic fundamentalism. You also lumped in there, interestingly, it seemed to me in the reading, atheism, people who are godless and confronting that. What does that mean? What is that confrontation all about, and does that help the rhetoric?
Yeah, no, I kind of think that's different. So I can't remember exactly what I said when I was there at Georgetown. But for me, and actually my foundation— you know, I know my dad's an atheist. You know, I'm very open to dialogue with people who are humanist and atheist and who say, look, I don't like religion. It's the cause of all the problems in the world. What I was really arguing is that one of the other purposes of my foundation is I actually do believe that faith is also an important part of progress. And so it's not so much taking on or confronting atheists, but trying to show that religion can do good in the world as well as harm.
Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. His book is A Journey, My Political Life, debuting at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations on your success. And proceeds to this go where? It's worth pointing out.
This goes to the Royal British Legion that looks after injured soldiers who've been injured in the conflicts, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.